Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, we observe Thanksgiving with the help of some friends. Friends like Jim Hightower, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and the Fire Sign Theater. So please pass the mincemeat and stay tuned.
Thanksgiving, let's eat! America's most food-focused holiday traces its roots back to the abundant feast that pilgrims and Indians enjoyed together in the fall of 1621. Only half of the Mayflower pilgrims who had arrived at Plymouth Rock the previous December survived their first year in the New World. New, of course, only to those undocumented immigrants from England, not to the local citizens. Still, to celebrate and offer thanks for their survival, the newcomers planned a communal meal following the fall harvest. And, in appreciation for being taught by the Wampanoag people how to raise corn and gather the region's seafood, they invited Massasoit, the tribal leader, to join them. He did, surprising the host by arriving with 90 members of his community. But the Wampanoag party didn't come empty-handed, bringing much of the fare for what became a three-day banquet featuring venison, duck, geese, wild furkeys, Wampanoag for gobblers, eels, mussels, lobster, gooseberries, plums, cornmeal pudding, popcorn balls, who knew, barley beer, and fortified wine. And you thought you overate at Thanksgiving. But this was not the first precursor of our annual November Foodapalooza. Texans assert that it began near El Paso in 1598, when the Manso and Piro tribes roasted ducks, geese, and fish over an open fire to give sustenance to a lost and bedraggled group of Spanish colonizers. Meanwhile, Floridians insist that the firstest of all Thanksgivings was in 1565, when the Timucuan people shared a stew of salt pork and garbanzo beans with Spanish settlers at St. Augustine. This is Jim Hightower saying, these interesting tidbits raise an equally interesting question for us to ponder this Thanksgiving. What would have happened to those pilgrims and Spanish settlers if the Native Americans had Donnie Trump around to build a big, beautiful wall?
Jim Hightower, starting off New World Notes' first ever Thanksgiving special. The first Thanksgiving was a big part of what little I had learned about the history of the white settling of North America. What I had learned, from childhood through early middle age, was quite a concoction of half-truths, outright lies, inventions, and, especially, glaring, staggering omissions. Now I'm at the point of thinking, maybe genocide is too mild a term for what happened since 1492. So today we'll hear three alternative histories. We heard Jim Hightower's gentle irony. Coming up, the Fire Sign Theater's satire, then Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz's well-researched catalog of horrors. We turn now to the Fire Sign Theater's extremely accurate, totally objective, and 100% true account of the white settlers' relations with the continent's previous tenants. It's called Temporarily Humboldt County. Here's a good chunk of it.
West. How long ago we leave Goshen?
About 2 hours ago. Ain't we ever gonna stop?
We're quite done, my boys. Wagon boss.
My fellow settlers.
Hold it down.
We stand here at the edge of civilization on the banks of the Mississippi River, looking west at our destiny. What may appear to the faint-hearted as a limitless expanse of God-forsaken wilderness
is
in reality a golden opportunity for humble, God-fearing people like ourselves and our families and our children and the generations a-coming to carve a new life out of the American Indian.
Welcome, white brother.
Engines! Pull the wagons up into a circle!
Why do you always do that?
We get better reception that way. Do you mind if I put this antenna up on yonder peak?
That's our sacred mountain.
This is our sacred antenna.
It's shaped like a cross, made out of aluminum. Got any aluminum?
We've still got some corn left.
Hey, corn, now we can make whiskey.
We've been waiting hundreds of years for this.
Invented Tom Collins.
Here, Injun, you want some fire water?
No. We were warned by our elders not to drink anything that would make us weak or silly.
Put it in their well.
That's not a well. It's the eye of the Holy Serpent Mound on which you're standing.
It's a butte.
No, it's a mound.
And right purty, too. Can you move it?
But why?
Railroad's coming through. Right now.
Stopping for?
We in Goshen yet?
Can't go no further. This here's Injun territory.
Well then, it's treaty time! My fellow Redskins, speaking for the Great White Father in Washington and all the American people, let me say we respect you, savages, for your native ability to instantly adapt and survive in whatever godforsaken wilderness we move you to. Out there. Sign here.
They did it!
No reason to complain. It's not so bad out there. We still have our people and our ceremonies and the sun, moon, and stars and the sand and the black stuff coming out of the ground.
Black stuff coming out of the ground?
Civilization! Oh!
It's nice out here in the desert. No rain, no crops, no white brother.
All out for Fort Stinkin' Desert. Whoa. Last Indian reservation for 2,000 miles. You got 15 minutes, folks. Get him while you can.
Get the senator back in the bus.
Sit over there.
Godfrey Daniel, pesky Redskins. Which way's Goshen?
Howdy there, colorful replica of America's past. When is the exciting in its primitive splendor snake dance going to take place?
It's usually in August, but with all our children off in Indian school, there's no one left to do the ceremonies.
Hiya, Pop.
I'm home.
Hello, Soaring Eagle. It's good to have you back from school.
Oh, come on. Call me Eddie. I'm an American now.
What have they been teaching you?
Just what we need for a better life. French horn, Italian, water polo.
Yes, at the Custer Memorial Indian School, Eddie's one of our prize students. We're giving him away next week.
Oh, my white brother.
Hey, man. Don't let him bring you down now. There's a lot of young people in this country just like myself who really know where the Indians at. Don't worry, soon we're all going to be out here on the reservation, living like Indians and dressing like Indians and doing all the simple, beautiful things that you Indians do. You got any peyote?
Hey, how much is that necklace you're wearing?
Do you know how to do the war dance?
Hold it, smile.
Isn't it amazing how they survive on this stinking desert?
You got any scalps?
Hey, let me get a shot of you and your squaw.
Hey, let's see the war dance.
Let's see the dance.
Let's see the dance.
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 Dance. Dance. Dance. Dance.
Folks, fun's over. Back in the bus.
Where's little Billy Joe?
He's in that run-down outhouse over there, Mama.
That's our sun altar.
Well, Indian, just goes to show you there's an obvious need to conserve our priceless national heritage. The government is turning your home into a national monument.
It behooves me upon this historic occasion to dedicate the Stinking Desert National Historical Indian Monument and Cobalt Testing Range. Civilization! Ho!
Well, it's about time. There's been no corn growing for the last few generations. The buffalo's gone. There's no one left to live in harmony.
I wonder where we went wrong.
Let's just keep to the life plan. Remember what the Great Spirit said. Follow the peaceful way. The true white brother is bound to come.
All right, Indians, get ready.
Winning of the West, the massacre, take four.
Well, let's go.
Finally, Native American scholar Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, reporting some of the facts of the white conquest of America. Facts they made sure you didn't learn in American history class in school. You'll see some interesting similarities to points the Fireside Theater made. The effects of the Indian schools, for example. Dunbar Ortiz is interviewed by Abby Martin on the show The Empire Files. Here's part of it.
Survival is really what should be talked about rather than disappearance because, well, Native people are still here. The settlers and their, you know, the armed settlers had to fight for every inch of land they took from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and from the Gulf to the Canadian border. And that cost a lot. They had five regiments of six that existed out in the Army of the West after the Civil War, fighting Plains people who were not that populous, not that many, but had horses, you know, had taken horses from the Spanish, and could defend themselves, so they couldn't defeat them. They had to make peace treaties with them, and they got very large settlements that were then whittled down politically as they made the Native communities completely dependent. In the case of the Plains people, they killed all the buffalo. It was sort of a buffalo genocide of 60 million buffalo in the Plains. And when they put the trains through, as a part of your train ticket, you got a rifle to shoot out the window. Buffalo's a big animal and not very hard to kill with a rifle. So basically Western counterinsurgency that came out of colonialism, it's what they call a food fight. They call it themselves the food fight, where you destroy the food supply of the people, the civilians. And then they have to sue, you know, they starve or they give in.
One of the things that particularly horrified me from your book, Roxanne, was that headhunting, scalp hunting was not an underground business. It was actually a lucrative economy. Talk more about this.
They actually had an ordinance that allowed for bounties to be paid for heads that were brought in. They brought this practice, in the colonization of Ireland, where they had started taking heads and then scalps or other body parts. It turned out, you know, the head was just, there were so many of them. Even in Ireland, they turned to scalps. They would use the heads also to terrorize people, put them along the paths and everything, to terrorize people into surrender because they'd see their families heads there, and they would hide the corpses so they couldn't even get their family member back. So it was partly terror, but it was also, it became a commercial market. And so no one checked very closely if it was supposed to be only when there were Indian uprisings or a war, but it became the practice after a few years. They could say, you know, these were warring Indians, but they could basically go in a village and just grab a bunch of children even, or elderly people, take their scalps, kill them, and sell them. You know, quite a lucrative trade for people to, especially poorer people, to make an income. And some people actually lived off of that income alone. You know, they were scalp hunters. So that spread, of course, everywhere throughout the colonies, and then the wars against the native people in east of the Mississippi, then west of the Mississippi, the scalp taking. So this is a commodity, the bodies themselves, but this left corpses. You know, the descriptions I've read of some people who were actually repelled by it wrote in their diaries and various things, letters back to England, these bloody bodies all over, because taking the scalp, of course, it causes blood to flow all over the body. They also often flayed the skin and used the skin of these people for various things. Jackson's army did that a lot. They used, they made their rein, they were very proud of the horse reins, were all made from Indian skins. So that kind of fetishism continued into the 20th century in Vietnam, where soldiers were sending back all kinds of body parts to their relatives and all. So it's a, you know, it's just kind of built into the military culture doing that, because it was malicious, but then those are the same people then who become parts of standing armies and so forth. So it was pretty much a free enterprise, all right, of doing that. But there was also the name they gave to what they would use, referring to this bloody corpse, is the term redskin. And that's why it's so repugnant to, you know, the ball team that calls itself that. It's not just any old misuse and appropriation of native names and symbols. It's ghoulish, you know, so it's a... But most people don't know the origin of the word redskin. It was a description of these bloody corpses whose heads have been cut off or their scalp taken.
Wow. And it's, you know, speaking of military culture, now you see native nomenclature embedded within the military establishment, mm-hmm. from equipment to weapons to unit. What is the significance of this?
Well, I call it a fetish, you know, that it built into the army, which in the United States has only rarely been used for any purpose except conquest. Even the Civil War, not to take the side of the Confederacy, but they pretty much used the same methods, you know, of scorched earth and food fight and so forth against the Southerners. I mean, they were fighting on Southern territory. But only in World War I, World War II, did you have late coming Americans fight a standard, what you think of as war. And that's why those wars are tooted so much and others kind of put aside. There has to be some kind of dehumanization involved. Most recently, and it's not so recent anymore to people, because, you know, those of us who were adults or students anyway in the 60s saw these things happening on television, and those of us who knew this history said, this rings a bell, you know, and also their use of the term Indian country for enemy territory. Almost every generation has to have a regeneration through violence in order to justify its actions, you know, by doing it again. And it does seem that way. And then, not to speak of the civilians who take it in their own hands, no more militias, so they just go out and shoot up a bunch of people. So there are these hanging threads of colonialism that are very troublesome, you know, in the culture, that people think, you know, banning guns or doing this or that without really considering what's the historical kind of psychological, what's at work there.
Before, when you were speaking about genocide and you know, how the term encompasses the institutionalized attempt to destroy a culture, a heritage, an entire peoples, I wanted you to just quickly address the re-education camps, because I don't think a lot of people really know that that happened and how many people were integrated in this dehumanizing process.
His name was Pratt, General Pratt. He said, let's teach them English and cut. So he has their hair cut off, puts them in army uniform, drills them all the time, and then gets some of the teachers from the colony there, the settlement, civilian settlement there, some of the teachers to come in and teach them English, and some of the, you know, others to encourage their artwork. And then he starts, they get so adjusted, you know, they're completely separated from their families and all. And they're told that they can be better off than being these savages that they were. And so they're, it's just kind of a brainwashing. He thinks this experiment works pretty well, and he builds it up into a report to the Department of War, which is what it was called at the time, to have this be more routine practice, to take the children away. He says it's hard with the adults. Some of them backslide, you know, and try to escape, and there's a rebel among them. But take them as children and put them far away from their families, cut their hair, and make them into... And his motto was to kill the Indian and save the man. So that was kill the Indian, that person, so they could just be an individual. Christianizing came along with it. So they set up these federal boarding schools, and then it became mandatory. All Native families had to bring their children in to be taken to. And so this whole network of boarding schools were set up. And they, if you didn't turn the children in, the army unit would come out and either take one of the people, usually the father of the family, away, imprison him until... You know, they said where they're hiding the kids. And somewhere there are some interesting stories of some families that were able to hide out some of the young people and hide them in caves and take food to them, you know, and they didn't learn English. So they became the transmitters of the culture because they realized what was happening. They took them away at 5 years old, and they couldn't return until 16. So they missed all of the elements of, you know, their cultural learning. So this was generations from the 1870s until the 1960s, 100 years of that. So there's still living people who went through that kind of, it was, you know, with the rise of the Native movement in the 1960s, at least by 1972, the Indian Self-Determination Act that was went through took away the mandatory requirement for the boarding schools.
What aspects of capitalism are still encroaching on Native peoples today?
Native peoples' land is mainly mining and oil extraction. It's been for a while, since post-World War II, when they identified, you know, uranium exists everywhere, but they made it seem like, and I remember this, that it was a rare substance found only in certain places that happened to be on Indian land, in Nevada and New Mexico and in the state of Washington. Interesting, you know, and these were the only places with uranium. But so they just devastated those lands, you know, with open pit uranium mines. The densest part of Indian land is New Mexico, and into northern Arizona, and they are just under the boot of resource extraction. And the pipelines, of course, are a big issue now, where they're trying to cross Native land and getting a lot of resistance from Native people.
And thousands of people recently came out to support Native-led struggle in New Mexico to have Columbus Day ended as a holiday, and they won. From Keystone XL, which is what you're talking about, to Change the Name movement, where's the struggle today, and how can we build solidarity with the movement of resistance?
The Native movement is, this year they've been working for years, you know, ever since we started going to the United Nations, you know, in 1977, demanding that Columbus Day not be a national holiday, and that there be a day of mourning on October 12th every year for the onset of colonialism that Columbus and genocide that Columbus represents as the initial act. And only Berkeley went for it, you know, like in the 1980s, Berkeley became declared Indigenous Peoples Day. Every year it happens, but this year, suddenly there was a shift, and city councils and like towns in Oklahoma and, of course, Albuquerque, these real colonial places, you know, were actually declaring the holiday. Washington State and Seattle and Portland. And so I think it was a real boost, you know. It's a small thing, it's a symbolic thing. The mascotry movement is really important, not just the Redskins, but there are Redskin, something like 300 high schools in the United States have Redskins as their name. So there's much local work that's done in these different places. You realize that it's not just about football or about the sport or about just hanging on to a name. It really is about keeping that history intact of domination.
On the same theme, I can report that this year, two high schools nearby, including in my own town of Manchester, changed the name of their mascots from Indians to Red Hawks. That way you can keep the school colors, you see. The Red Hawk is a local bird, though it is an aggressive raptor. Not the best role model for impressionable teenagers, I think. Now, unlike many progressives, I know a fair amount about firearms, and I have become very much pro-gun rights and pro-Second Amendment. So sue me. I have this devilish urge to thank my Manchester school board for changing the team's name from the offensive Indians to honor the name of the celebrated 44 Magnum double-action revolver, the Ruger Red Hawk, introduced in 1979. This fine, famous, and expensive revolver, the product of Sturm, Ruger & Company, founded right here in Connecticut. My letter continues. I am pleased Manchester School Board chose to honor the late William B. Ruger and his fine firearms. So, go Red Hawks! Just a little fantasy of mine. And here we must close New World Notes' first ever Thanksgiving special. Hear it again at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, pass the cranberry sauce, have a safe and sane Thanksgiving, and please tune in again next week. Till then.